And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM. Actually, it's the last day, I think, to vote for us for the Hamilton Independent Media Awards, which you can find at HIMAS.ca. And thanks to everyone who came out for the Eve Engler talk yesterday. It was very successful. And speaking of Canadians who cover our foreign policy, we should be interviewing today Stephen Gowans. Stephen Gowans, one of our regular guests, either directly or by proxy. I think he's joining us now. Hi, Steve. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Brendan. How are you?
Well, not too bad. It's a busy week for everyone, nothing stops you. You just announced a book, and now you've got a new article looking at Yemen. Interesting case, interesting scenario. I'm glad you are looking at some of the bigger problems. I guess you see, as you pointed out, we're all talking about the Saudi war on Yemen and what the Saudis are doing. And by we, I mean people who are watching this, because most people are not even aware of what the Saudis are doing. But it's not just the Saudis. It's much bigger than that. And they can't operate without the United States. But, I mean, you pointed out in your article that there's some significant operations going on in Yemen, totally illegal. And the Saudis are doing a lot. So I'm wondering if you can tell us maybe first what the Saudis are doing in Yemen militarily, and what are the consequences of this bombing?
Okay, well, let me tell you about the consequences. First of all, the United States acknowledges that there is a bombing going on and that it's indiscriminate. And they say it's indiscriminate because Saudi pilots do not have sufficient experience and because it's difficult to distinguish militants who aren't wearing uniforms from civilians. So they're acknowledging that the bombing is indiscriminate, that indiscriminate bombing is a war crime. The impact of this, well, there are tens of thousands of dead and many more wounded. If you look into this, you'll see various numbers on deaths and casualties. And they don't always agree, but they all agree that there are tens of thousands dead. About 10% of Yemen's population has been displaced, is homeless. The aggression has created near famine conditions for somewhere between 25 to 40% of the population. And we also know that there's a cholera outbreak, which has been, can be caused by many things, but the bombing campaign and aerial and naval blockades have contributed to that.
Yeah, no, it's pretty serious. It's probably one of the worst, if not the worst, humanitarian situation in the world right now. You pointed out there's near famine conditions, and this was in your article. It's called "The U.S.-Led War on Yemen," right on your blog, gowans.wordpress.com. Near famine conditions for 25 to 40% of the population, and some of us have seen the images coming out of Yemen of absolutely emaciated children, and actually it's horrifying to look at, and it's extremely depressing because, of course, this doesn't need to be happening at all, and they were doing fine before the Saudis and the United States came in there, and you got tens of thousands dead, you got many wounded, but, you know, of course, here I am committing the mistake of calling this a Saudi operation, because although they're the front man on this thing, the clock doesn't work without the United States. And you took great pains to show in your article how the United States facilitates this bombing of Yemen. So can you tell us how, you know, the United States is integral to this operation?
Yes. I mean, if you read any of the news reports about this, you'll always see some reference to the United States providing support. Or if we look even deeper, there was a Reuters exclusive that was published, I think it was in 2016, in which two Reuters reporters discovered that some State Department officials had warned the White House that the United States could be charged with war crimes in connection with the Saudi bombing. And the reason why is because the United States is a co-belligerent. Now, this article said, well, you know, what the United States does is it provides aerial refueling to Saudi bombers and also provides the bombs, which Saudi pilots drop on Yemen. But if you explore some of these articles more deeply and look at exactly what they're saying, you'll discover that the United States is doing more than simply providing support. It does provide support, but it provides a whole lot more than that. So, for example, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Pentagon had acknowledged that the U.S. has special operations forces on the ground, provides airborne intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, maritime interdiction, so it's part of the naval blockade, security, medical support, aerial refueling, and here's a significant point, also operational planning. It also mentioned that Pentagon war planners run a joint operations center where bombing targets are selected. So when you look at this, you ask the question, well, what is it that the Saudis do? I mean, the United States provides the warplanes, it provides the bombs, it trains the pilots who fly the warplanes, it flies its own drones and its own reconnaissance aircraft over Yemen to gather intelligence. It then runs the operations center where they select the bombing targets. So the United States is doing everything except providing the pilots who fly the planes. And these pilots who fly the planes are, by the United States' own admission, inexperienced, and as a result of their inexperience, they bomb indiscriminately. So, I mean, it's not a Saudi-led war, it's a U.S.-led war. And even when you're talking about led, you know, the United States is using Saudi pilots as the tip of a spear, in the same way in which the United States uses Kurd forces in Syria and Iraq as the tip of the spear in the U.S. fight against ISIS. In that case, we don't say that the fight against ISIS is Kurd-led, because Kurds are the tip of the spear. We recognize that this is U.S.-led. Well, likewise, in Yemen, just because, I mean, the United States is using Saudi pilots as the tip of the spear, but it's behind the scenes providing all of the equipment, providing all of the intelligence, providing all of the support, and doing the operational planning. So when you run the operations center and you do the operational planning, you run the war.
Well, that's what it means to run a global empire. You have your proxies in various locations. You help run or own one faction of a country or a group, Kurdistan, Kurds, the Saudis in particular, as a whole country run by a monarchy that is basically dependent on the U.S. in order to stay in power, just as the United States in many ways is dependent on them. And for those who are just tuning in, we're speaking with Stephen Gowans, and Stephen is an author and journalist, author of now two books. We'll get into that. You can find his blog at gowans.wordpress.com. On the global aspects of this, it's incredible. People don't even know what's happening in Yemen in the first place, never mind, you know, the U.S. role in that. I mean, you've gone beyond what I was going to say, because I was just going to say, you know, the whole thing grinds to a halt without the United States, without them providing the bombs, without them refueling the jets for the strike missions, etc. You know, the whole thing grinds to a halt, but it's more than that. I mean, they're running the whole show because, as you point out, they're running the operations center to coordinate the campaign. And, you know, it's caused embarrassment for some people in the State Department who think they could run afoul of the own legal, you know, constructions they've created to talk about war crimes and so on. So that's the situation. But, you know, all these things are happening. Why is it happening? We have Yemen, and I've pointed out on the program before, it's the poorest country in that region, and it's being attacked by the richest country in the region and the richest country in the world. So, you know, what have they done to deserve this? It's actually quite catastrophic, the civilian conditions there, and in this ongoing campaign, which the Saudis are now talking about intensifying, if I've understood recent news reports correctly. So, you know, what have these Houthis done to get the ire of the United States war planners and these the Saudi proxies?
Right, and well, you know, one thing that's often forgotten is that the United States was waging a war in Yemen. We never say anything about that, but it had been waging a war in Yemen against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. That had been going on for quite some time. And it was a U.S.-led war, called the U.S.-led war, But somehow we seem to have forgotten that, and no one talks about that. Instead, we talk about the Saudi-led war. And the Saudi-led war, we say, is on the Houthis. And we say it's against the Houthis because the Houthis are a proxy of Iran. Well, they're not a proxy of Iran, and that's complete nonsense. And the reason I say it's complete nonsense is because the U.S. Intelligence community says it's complete nonsense. They had a report saying that Iran does not exercise command and control over the Houthis, and that it's a mistake to assume they do. But this is part of the illusion that the United States was creating, or part of the story, the narrative that the United States created to present this war as Saudi-led, was to say, well, you know, it's the Saudis, they're after the Houthis, and they don't like the Houthis because the Houthis are simply an extension of the Iranians, and the Iranians are the principal regional adversary of Saudi Arabia. But who are the Houthis? You're right. I mean, that's the question you ask. Who are they and what do they want? Or what's more important is what do they want? On one level, what they want is exactly what Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula wanted, and that is for the United States to go away, to get out of their region, to leave them alone. That's one thing they want, and that's one of the reasons that the United States was waging a war against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, because Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is a group that was vehemently opposed to a U.S. presence in the Arab and Muslim world. Well, likewise, the Houthis, which have a different agenda than Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but it has an agenda which overlaps that of Al-Qaeda in wanting the Americans out. So what the Houthis have said, what's their political project, their self-stated aim is to cleanse the country, and that's their words, cleanse the country of corrupt leaders beholden to foreign powers. The leader the Houthis ousted, Hadi, was a U.S. puppet. We can go into the story about Hadi, but anyway, for the moment, we can say that the Houthis regard Hadi as a puppet. They're against the interference of the United States in Israel and Yemen's affairs. That's their words. The Houthi spokesman says, we're simply against the interference of those governments. Now, in 2015, Newsweek reported that, in essence, what the Houthis call for are the things that all Yemenis crave. So they want government accountability, they want the end of corruption, they want regular utilities, they want fair fuel prices, they want job opportunities for ordinary Yemenis, and they want the end of Western influence in their country. And Newsweek reported, quote, many Yemenis believe the Houthis are right in pushing out Western influence and decision-making. So that's why the United States is running a war in Yemen. It's running two wars. It was running a war against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and now it's overlaid on that war, a war against the Houthis. But why does it call the war against the Houthis a Saudi-led war, rather than simply a U.S.-led war? I mean, if it could fly drones and send CIA people and special forces into Yemen to battle Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, why isn't it doing the same with the Houthis?
Well, as usual, they're turning things around because the United States is running a proxy war in Yemen, and they accuse, for example, Iran of running a proxy war in Yemen. As usual, it's the United States, and there's a parallel. I know it's not discussed much in the article, but the direct parallel is, of course, people talk about the Saudi-Turkish invasion of Syria, the Saudi-Turkish-Qatari proxies in Syria. They have all these different groups, ISIS and al-Nusra and a bunch of alphabet soup organizations that were wreaking havoc until recently in Syria. But, you know, that was not a Saudi Turkish-Qatari war on Syria. That was a U.S. war on Syria, and that was done through proxy organizations, right? It's the same game plan, isn't it?
Right. But then you can ask the question, why is that? And the reason why is because the United States has the problem. The U.S. administration has the problem. It's a hindrance for them. They have to have a legal authorization for war. And they have a legal authorization that was provided in 2001 by the Congress, which allows them it's an open-ended authorization to wage war against anyone who is connected with the 9/11 attacks, which is why they could wage a war against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But they can't wage a war openly against the Houthis because they don't have a legal authorization to do so. So they use a proxy, essentially they run the war, but they put someone else out front and then say it's that group's war.
It's funny how their 9/11 authorization doesn't authorize them to cut off relations with the Saudis or to, you know, stop giving arms and stuff to al-Nusra and under the guise of the Free Syrian Army. And somehow that has escaped them.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah.
Well, I know you like to see the big picture on things, and, you know, it got me thinking of the article also just previous to that one, and it's, of course, the announcement of your new book, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. Now, obviously, this is very contrary or counter to pretty much any reporting in the for-profit media on the issue of Korea, whether you're looking at North, South. There has been an ongoing war between the United States and North Korea, which has not technically ended, if I understand correctly. So when the news reports talk about these, you know, aggressive statements, Trump, and they talk about Korea and what the Koreans are saying, this is their war has not actually ended. And as far as North Korea is concerned, it could be attacked at any time. And certainly the U.S. has done nothing to dispel that notion. It goes back a long way because there has been widespread support throughout Korea, North and South, for the idea of Korean independence. The idea that, Korea is supposed to be a country where they can, you know, determine their own fate and their own future. And all sorts of people have come in there to meddle with that idea, namely the Japanese, but then that mantle was taken up by the Americans, who are still, you know, pushing for South Korea to just be a sort of military bastion for the United States. So, I mean, is that what you're talking about in the book, the sense that the, there's this desire for Korea to be a country where they can choose how they want to do things, and that's an ongoing thing, and this is really getting frustrated.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the United States is the successor occupation to the Japanese. So the Japanese had colonized Korea beginning in 1910. They established a protectorate over Korea in 1905. And then when they are defeated in the end of the Second World War, Koreans, almost immediately, established their own republic, the Korean People's Republic. But the peninsula had been divided between the Soviet Union and the United States to accept the Japanese surrender. And the division was supposed to be temporary, to last no more than 5 years. And before the end of the five-year period, the U.S. and Soviet occupation forces would leave, and there would be national elections, and there would be a pan-Korean government. Well, the United States figured out pretty quickly that it was probably Kim Il-sung, who is the grandfather of the current leader of North Korea, who was going to win that election, and that they didn't want to see. So they organized the political division of Korea. Essentially what they did was they organized elections to be held in the South in their occupation zone. And they used all kinds of maneuvers to ensure that their guy won, who was Syngman Rhee. And there had been, from 1945, at the point that the United States arrived in South Korea, until 1950, a very fierce guerrilla war going on within the South to drive the Americans out, because the Americans were simply recognized as, you know, the succession to a Japanese occupation. And after the Republic of Korea was established in the South in 1948, a guerrilla war continued, a very significant guerrilla war as well in the South. So yes, it is the case that the United States essentially established a puppet regime within the South. Interestingly, the Japanese had a puppet state in Manchuria, which borders on Korea, which was called Manchukuo. And everyone always calls it the puppet state of, and yet they don't call the Republic of Korea the puppet state of the United States. North Korea calls it that. And sometimes the United States and the U.S. press will acknowledge that there's a lot of sensitivity in South Korea, that, you know, the North Koreans make the case that we're just a puppet of the United States, and they might have a point. I mean, that's always acknowledged. They might have a point. And this argument is going on at this very moment because the United States has wartime operational control of the South Korean military. For many years, they had complete operational control of the South Korean military. But right now, the South Korean military has control, or rather, South Korea has control of its own military during peacetime. But in the event of a war, an American commander would command South Korean forces. The current president of South Korea has asked the United States, well, this should be an indication that it's a puppet state, it has to go and ask the United States to allow his military to report to him. He said, we need wartime control. And the South Korean general said, well, I don't know if we can actually have the Americans relinquish their wartime control. And the Americans have said, we're not sure that you're ready. We're not really interested in having that conversation. And yet, South Korea is quite able to defend itself. It has twice the population of North Korea. Its GDP is much bigger. Its armed forces are far more sophisticated than the North Koreans are. So they are in a position to defend themselves. In fact, they're in a position, they're so strong militarily that they really threaten the North Koreans. There's no question that in a battle between the North Koreans and the South Koreans, that the South Koreans would win. And yet, they are a very interesting auxiliary to the U.S. military. Something that's not widely recognized is that during the Vietnam War, that the South Koreans sent 300,000 troops to fight in that war on behalf of the United States. Now, it's pointed out that the Americans had to station their own troops in Korea on the ground that they were there to protect the South Koreans from the North, but somehow they were able to spare 300,000 troops to go to Vietnam.
Yes. Well, the more you look at it, you know, the more questionable it all becomes. This is why I wanted to ask you about this, because when you're talking about North Korea, South Korea, but specifically the DPRK in the English language in Canada or the U.S., there's such a limited field of expertise you can draw upon that doesn't rely on cliches that from people who are just mindlessly repeating cliches. And you know, in the case of North Korea, the reporting has become so bad, so inaccurate, that you can't rely on it for basic information. And the idea that, you know, the whole country is just a devastated mess and everyone's starving to death, the studies are coming out in some academic journals and things talking about economic recovery in parts of the country, rebuilding, talking about, you know, the large parts of the famine or problems of the 90s being over, new construction in North Korea, all these things to the point where, you know, if you had to actually, you know, write reports for the U.S. government or the Canadian government or, you know, big corporations, you have to go do your own research and your own digging because, you know, the actual things you're relying on are just wrong and out of date and ridiculous. And so you've looked at the history of the question, and what people are thinking and some of the main arguments, in Korea and South Korea and North Korea. And, so, I mean, it's very valuable that you're doing that because the amount of credible research on the country is almost nil. It's almost nil. And, so your book makes a splash just by existing for first and foremost, but also because it's such a passion of yours. So I'm glad, that this has come out and that we're going to learn more about it. And it'll be on your blog and that you'll be launching it. And, this is really an opportunity to rectify what's an embarrassing gap in Canada, U.S. knowledge, which has a reverse Disneyland view of North Korea, where it's like an evil Disneyland where, you know, the Joker is in control and you can't even make accurate policy on the country because people don't actually know what's happening. So people they're going to be able to find all the information about this, because you've got your blog, gowans.wordpress.com, and you have a book coming out that's going to be announced, Baraka Books and other outlets and institutions. So we're looking forward to that. We're going to be hearing about that, and I know you'll be interviewed more about that, and we'll probably be reposting some of those interviews here on the program. So, you know, this is valuable to us, and it's really something people actually need to take a look at, what's actually going on, and not just clickbait and stuff like that. So that's valuable, and I just want to thank you again for being on the program with us today.
Well, thank you, Brendan.
Okay, we'll catch you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. That was Stephen Gowans, and as I said, you can find his blog, What's Left, gowans.wordpress.com. We were talking about his article about the U.S.-led war on Yemen, and it shows that there needs to be a greater maturity in these discussions, because sometimes people take the easy way out, the cheap way out, and they talk about the Saudis doing something in Yemen, or the Saudis doing something in Syria, the Saudis and their friends, or the bickering between the Saudis and the Qataris and Turkey over which terrorist group is going to run Syria and so on. These are small fries. This is secondary. None of those operations go forward without the United States, and Stephen has been helpful in pointing that out, and I'm sure you'd find that to be the case in certain other conflicts as well.